All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday morning after spring break, 11:10 a.m. We're here for Chem 12A, and we're going to pick up right where we left off, which, since it's been spring break, we probably all forgot where we left off. We were doing stereochemistry, and I think I was just reviewing my notes, looking at what I said we were going to pick up with, and I was going to do optical activity. What else did I have? I don't know. I got a bunch of things for us today. We'll see as we get into it. Let me jump in with optical activity, and I'll show you how we do these types of calculations. So we don't do a whole lot of calculations in Chem 12, but this is one area where we can do a little bit of calculation, although we don't do a whole lot of it. But it's good to see kind of how this works. So with optical activity, we use an instrument that is called a spectroscope. And because molecules that are chiral will rotate plane polarized light, that rotation of plane polarized light tells us about the purity of a sample. It tells us about a number of different things. It tells us about the property of the chiral molecule that we're looking at. It tells us which direction it rotates plane polarized light. It tells us to what degree it rotates plane polarized light. But where we have samples that are mixed samples that have both enantiomers in different ratios, we can actually calculate. We can use the rotation of plane polarized light. If we know what the standard rotation is supposed to be, we can actually calculate what the degree of the mixture is. And we'll take a look at that as well. So just an overview of what optical activity looks like in terms of a spectroscope. What we use is a light source. We use a sodium D light. This is a special type of light bulb that is made with a sodium filament. And that outputs light that, when it comes out, is in all different directions. So each one of these we can think of as a vector for the direction that the light is oriented. And what we do is we take that and we pass it through a filter. And oftentimes these filters are drawn as square or as round. Use a square filter. They have very fine slits in them. And what the slits do is they knock out light that is coming in any orientation other than in line with the slits. And this then creates what is called plane polarized light. That light is then passed through a sample chamber. The sample chamber design is basically a tube, and it has a couple of ports to be able to fill and to allow air out of that chamber so that the chamber can be entirely filled with sample, such that the sample level is all the way up to the top of these ports so that there's no air bubbles inside of it. The light passes through that sample chamber, and as it passes through, it comes out the other side. The original orientation of the light was perfectly vertical, but due to the interaction with the molecule that is in the sample chamber, the light will rotate through some angle, and that angle we generally call alpha. And then what we do is we use another device, another filter here that we rotate. And the filter then rotates in order to be able to tell us what the angle is of the light. And so we can take this thing and we can rotate, let's say that this is 0 degrees. If we rotate clockwise or counterclockwise, the rotation of clockwise is positive. The rotation of counterclockwise is negative. And then what we do is we view that and we rotate that little lens until the light becomes its absolute brightest. When the light becomes its absolute brightest, that means that the lens here is in line with the orientation of the light that's coming out of the sample. And then we can measure the angle through which we rotated it when that gives us the rotation. So this experiment, we define a quantity called specific rotation. That specific rotation is given a symbol. The symbol is alpha in square brackets, and we give it a temperature, and we give it a wavelength of light. So this is temp, this is wavelength. And this is defined as equal to alpha, the observed rotation, divided by the concentration and the path length. So alpha equals the observed rotation C equals the concentration. And that concentration is in grams per milliliter. So it's not in molar or moles per liter, it's in grams per milliliter. L is the path length. That path length is in decimeters, so tenths of a meter. And then that D that I used, that I said was wavelength, this is what is called the sodium D line. And the sodium D line is equal to 589 nanometers. It was a convenient light source to use of monochromatic light in the early, I want to say, let's be 1800s. It was an easily accessible light that gave a monochromatic light, and that was chosen as the standard, was the sodium D line. And the temperature is represented in degrees Celsius and is given at the time of the measurement, but does not affect the measurement per se. It is not within the calculation for calculating out what the specific rotation is. So this is how we calculate specific rotation. And when we're given a specific rotation for a compound, this is the way that that specific rotation is derived. So just to give you an example, we can look at a compound called limonene. And I'll give you the compound and the measurements. Limonene is a terpene. Terpenes are compounds that have 10 carbons in them. They are often produced by plants, by natural products, and these terpenes oftentimes have stereocenters in them. And when they are produced within a plant, they are produced as a single enantiomer within the plant. The plant generally does not make both enantiomers of the terpene, it only makes one. So these are natural sources of enantiomerically pure compounds that we can then take and measure the optical activity of these compounds. This compound happens to be the R plus isomer. So we know its absolute configuration. Limonene is the compound that is found in mandarins, in oranges, and in a number of different, like pine trees and things. Limonene gives a scent of lemons, essentially. And the measurements for this, let's call it 100 milliliters of sample. And so the concentration is 100 milliliters, and it's got 12.3 grams in that 100 milliliters. Say solution containing 12.3 grams of limonene. Measurements taken at 20 degrees C. It's a 10 centimeter tube. And so 10 centimeter tube is equal to 1 decimeter. The observed rotation when measuring this would be 15.60 degrees of rotation. And we want to know what the specific rotation is. So the way we go through and do that is a simple calculation. Specific rotation is equal to the 20 degrees Celsius, the sodium D line. And this is equal to the observed rotation of 15.60 degrees divided by 1 decimeter times the concentration, which is 12.30 grams over 100 milliliters, grams per milliliter. And we just punch that into a calculation. We get 126.8 degrees. And units on this would be degrees, milliliters per decimeter gram. Is the way that works out. So we're going to get decimeters times grams in the denominator. Milliliters is going to flip up into the numerator. Degrees is also in the milliliter. But generally what we do is we don't report it with all of those units. The way that we report it is we generally just report this. We say the specific rotation at 20 degrees C, D is equal to 126.8 degrees. And then we generally put the concentration at 0.123. And we say what the solution was, that this was in hexane. So that was the solvent that was used. And we don't put the rest of these units. We just think of it as an optical rotation of degrees, although those units are essentially associated with it. So that's how we do it. And the experiment would be just as simple as taking and making a solution, measuring how much of the compound you place into the solution, the total volume of the solution, the size of the tube, and then putting that into the instrument, the spectrophotometer, and measuring the angle of rotation. And then you can calculate out your specific rotation. So it's a pretty simple measurement to do, actually. And it's not generally something that I ask you to calculate. It's not something that I generally put on a test and say, what is the optical rotation of this compound giving all these measurements? Because it is a fairly simple thing to do. But one of the questions that you might have is when looking at a sample for the first time, let's say that you have a sample that you never measured before, how do you know whether or not the rotation is clockwise or counterclockwise? So the question we're asking here is, what if a new molecule has never been measured? How do we know if the rotation is clockwise or counterclockwise? In other words, what we can do is we can take a look at a rotation, and let's say that this is the 0 degree mark here, and what we observe is a rotation that puts us over in this direction. And it could be that the rotation could be in the clockwise orientation, and that this could be plus 32 degrees. Or it could be that this is in the counterclockwise orientation, and that coming all the way over here would be minus 328 degrees. And so which way is it rotating the light? Is it rotating light clockwise or is it rotating light counterclockwise? That's the question. So let's say that we had this new molecule. And in the new molecule, what we've got is 23.2 grams. And this is in 100 milliliters of methanol. And we've got 20 degrees C. We've got a 1 decimeter tube. And the observed rotation equals either plus 32 or minus 328. And the question then is, how do we resolve this? What do we do? Well, consider what happens if you were to cut the concentration in half. If you were to cut the concentration in half, then the rotation should be cut in half. And so if we cut the concentration in half and we remeasure the optical rotation, then we should see one of two things. So if the rotation was positive 32 degrees, then when we cut that concentration in half, what we should see is that originally we were here, this was zero, and we were at plus 32, then the new rotation would be here and would be at 16. If the rotation were minus 328, then we do the same thing. We cut the concentration in half, but what we'll see is that the optical rotation won't go to plus 16. It will fall back the other direction and will be minus 164. So I would have to cut this angle in half, and I think I would be somewhere in this range at new rotation here would be minus 164. Yeah. This would have been if it were minus 328. So new alpha at half concentration would equal plus 16, new alpha at half concentration would equal minus 164. And so we can tell then whether or not the rotation were clockwise or counterclockwise just by cutting the concentration in half and remeasuring it and seeing where the optical rotation goes to. And that would allow us to be able to tell whether or not the original rotation were positive or negative. And that's in practice what we have to do. When it's a brand new compound and it's never been measured before, you can't just run the optical rotation and call it positive, because sometimes the rotations can be small, in which case it might be positive. But sometimes the rotations could be very, very large for certain compounds, and those rotations could be negative. And so that's how we go through and figure it out. Okay, I also said that in doing the optical rotations, that we can calculate the concentration of the different enantiomers if it happened to be a mixture. And so we have a couple of different terms for mixtures. So mixtures of enantiomers. Mixtures of enantiomers can fall into a number of different types. We can have equal amounts of each enantiomer, This is a solution that is called racemic. Or we can have unequal. And when we have unequal amounts, then we have solutions that are said to be non-racemic. And these non-racemic mixtures have what is called enantiomeric excess. Enantiomeric excess is the excess of one enantiomer over another. And it actually has definition, a mathematical definition, in the way that we report it. We can also have a pure enantiomer. In this case, what we say is that the material is either single isomer we say that it is enantiomerically pure. We say that it's optically pure. So there's a whole bunch of different ways of referring to a compound that is just a single isomer that doesn't have the other enantiomer in it. We can say that it's a single isomer. We can say that it's enantiomerically pure. We can say that it's optically pure. All of those different ways refer to just a pure compound. Now, I said the enantiomeric excess. This is actually a numerical value, a calculation that we can use. And what we do is we call it percent EE. Actually, the EEs are usually lowercase, not uppercase. Percent EE equals the percent of enantiomeric excess. And it's a measurement of the enantiomeric excess. And it has several definitions. One of the definitions, the simplest definition, is to look at percent EE as equal to the absolute value of the percent R minus the percent S. That's the easiest definition to use. And it's a little bit different than what you might think. So let's say that we have a sample that is 75% R and 25% S. Then what you would get is you would get 75% R minus 25% S. You would take the absolute value of that, and that's going to be equal to 50%. Enantiomeric excess. And so 50% enantiomeric excess doesn't mean that I have 50-50. It means that I have 50% more of one enantiomer than another. So it's a little bit different. We might think that if I had 75% R, that it would be 75% EE, but that's not the case. The way the definition is that it's the excess, it's percent excess. And so I have to take one and subtract the other and then do the absolute value. So that's the way that we go through and do that. Now there's a bunch of different definitions. That's, like I said, the easiest definition is to take the percent R minus the percent S. But we can also do percent enantiomeric excess can be calculated this way. It is the absolute value of the observed rotation. So regardless of sign, and then we divide that by the absolute value of the pure enantiomer. So this would be the looking at how much light the pure enantiomer rotates. And then you multiply this by 100, and this gives you percent enantiomeric excess. This is how we calculate from an experiment that if we're taking and we're doing the optical rotation on the sample and we want to know whether a sample is pure or not, if we know the optical activity of the pure enantiomer and we take our observed optical activity and then divide it by the pure and multiply by 100, it will give us the percent enantiomeric excess, the percent of one over the other. The other way to do this is if you happen to know what the mole ratios are. So percent EE can also be calculated this way. Percent EE equals the absolute value of the number of moles of R, subtract the number of moles of S, and that's divided by the number of moles of R plus the number of moles of S. The total number of moles of the sample multiplied by 100. So all three of these definitions give the exact same value and can be used in different situations in order to figure out what the percent enantiomeric excess of a sample actually is. And these are important measurements to understand because anytime we make a medication that is or has a stereocenter in that medication, we need to be sure that that medication that is being sold is 100% pure enantiomeric excess. And so measuring the percent EE of the material becomes a critical aspect of being able to use it as a medication, because oftentimes drugs that have a stereocenter within them, if they're sold as, how do I put it this way? Going back to the thalidomide story, as I said, thalidomide that was used to treat morning sickness in people, that one of those drugs was the beneficial drug that actually cured morning sickness. The other one was a teratogen that caused birth defects. So the different enantiomers can react differently within the body. And we need, when we make a drug now by FDA standards, that drug has to be enantiomerically pure, or if it's going to be sold as a racemate or as some mixture, they need to verify that the enantiomer does not cause any harm. Most of the time, that's harder to do. And so what they typically do with these is they make the drugs enantiomerically pure, in which case we have to know or have a way of measuring what the percent enantiomeric excess of that material actually is. And we need to show that it's 100% EE before being used as a drug. So these are non-trivial calculations and the number of ways in which we can go through and actually calculate out what percent EE means, what percent EE is. There's a couple of other things that are in this chapter. I've already gone through how to draw enantiomers. We've talked about how to draw enantiomers the last time. What I didn't do, and what's in this chapter, is also Fisher projections. So we should spend just a little bit of time talking about Fisher projections. Fisher projections, when we talk about ways of representing molecules that have stereocenters. Let's call them stereogenic centers. When we look at the ways of representing molecules that have stereogenic centers, the one way that we think of generally is to be able to use the wedge and hash bonds. And so we use a series of wedge and hash bonds to represent the configuration of each one of these stereogenic centers. We've already talked about this. I'll just hit it here again really quickly, that the wedge and hash bonds, wedge is forward, hash is backwards. Sometimes what we do is we represent a molecule that has a stereogenic center and we put a wiggly bond. The wiggly bond is meant to represent both isomers. It's meant to represent something that is 0% enantiomeric excess. It's meant to represent something that is racemic. Racemic means 50-50 mix, or 0% enantiomeric excess. So this represents the molecule which has both the forward and the backward, and that these are in equal concentration. That's what the wiggly bond represents. It's meant to represent that I know that it's a stereocenter, but it's representing both molecules. So that's another way that we do that. And then we get into Fischer projections. So Fischer projections are used for molecules that have many different stereocenters. They're a little bit harder to understand, a little bit harder to use. They're used for carbohydrates in particular. These are molecules, linear molecules, I should say.
Is this kind of like the Newman projection, or is it different?
It's different.
Okay.
Fischer projections are different. There's two different things. There's Fischer projections, and then there's what's called Haworth projections. Haworth are for cyclic molecules. Fischer projections are for linear molecules. And they're used for molecules that typically have many different stereocenters. So 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In this case, I'm going to draw a carbohydrate. This is glucose. So this one is called D-glucose. And what they do with a molecule like this is, in order to make it easy to represent and to draw it in a way that's easy to read, they take it and they put it in a specific orientation. So the first thing that they do is we need to recognize that this molecule, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, can be drawn this way, representing each of the stereocenters as having a forwards and a backwards, where the hydroxyl is and where the hydrogen is. And we'll go through and we'll just put the hydroxyls and hydrogens in on each carbon. And then what we do is we rotate the molecule. So after we draw it this way, then we go through and we rotate such that all of the stereocenters are pointing the same direction. So we want these to all orient towards us, essentially. So I'm going to go through a couple of different renditions of drawing here in order to get it to do the thing that I want it to do. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to draw that carbonyl. And then instead of drawing a zigzag pattern, I'll make my bonds a little bit longer here. Instead of drawing a zigzag pattern, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take and just let this molecule curl in around on itself. So let me number the carbons. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So there are 6 carbons. That's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And then what I'll do is I'll go in and I'll put in each of the stereocenters. And the stereocenters, as I put them in, some of them are going to change their orientation. In other words, this guy here, where the hydroxyl group is going forward, if I rotate it so it's in the downwards position as number 3 is here, then the hydroxyl group winds up going back. And number 4, these two were already down, so number 4 will stay exactly as it is. This is much, much easier to do with a model than it is to do mentally. The hydroxyl group on number 5 is back, but when I rotate it in order to turn this bond down, that hydroxyl group is going to come forward towards me. And then the last one, I don't need to worry about because the last one's not a stereocenter. And then what I do is all the legs now are pointed the same direction. That's the key thing that I was trying to do. Then what I do is I artificially flatten it out. And I make it as if it's a millipede walking on all of those legs. So we flatten the molecule and we draw it this way. Here's the aldehyde. And then I have the different carbons, each one with its little hydroxyl group or hydrogen oriented in the way that it's positioned in the molecule to the right. I'll keep track of my numbers. This was number 1, 2, 3, 4. I'll catch 5 here and 6 here. So at 5, the hydroxyl group is forward. And at 6 is the one that I don't really have to keep track of. So there's my OH on 6. Then what I do is I stand this thing upright and I look at it from this direction. And I stand it upright. And by standing it upright, what I mean is I look at it with the most oxidized carbon at the top. And then I draw that molecule, and I'm looking at it now with these bonds pointed towards me. And so as I look at it now, every one of these is going to be coming towards me. So I'm picking it up and I'm looking at the legs. And I have to be very careful about what is on the right and what is on the left. I don't know why I can't draw that last triangle. Come on, last triangle, there we go. Okay, so this is carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and finally 6 down here at the bottom. And as I pick that up and look at it, what I'll see is that I have a hydroxyl group on the right, hydroxyl group on the left, hydroxyl group on the right, and on the right, and then on the opposite sides are hydrogens. And then that last one has an OH just coming off of it, off of carbon number 6. And then we do one more thing. We represent it this way. We get rid of the wedge bonds because the wedge bonds are hard to draw. And we just draw it with straight bonds across. But these straight bonds that are going across mean the same thing as the wedge bonds. I just draw them in on the straight bonds. And this is the Fischer projection.
We looked at this earlier in the semester, right? Fischer projection?
We did. No, I don't
think. Maybe I'm remembering. I might be remembering the last semester in Chem 1B.
Might be that you looked at it. It might be that you looked at it in 1B, but we haven't done 12 yet.
Yeah, it looks very familiar. I do remember this.
That's good. Okay. If that it looks familiar and that you did it in 1B, that's a good thing. So the Fischer projection. The way that the Fischer projection is read is that we look at the last stereocenter and we look at the most oxidized group or the highest priority group on the last stereocenter. And if that group is on the right, then this is said to be a D sugar. If that group is on the left, then it's said to be an L sugar. So in Fischer projections, we always put the most oxidized carbon at the top. And then we have the series of stereocenters. And if the OH group happens to be on the right, then this is said to be a D sugar. And if we do it, put the most oxidized at the top. We look at all the stereocenters, and the last stereocenter, the OH, happens to be on the left. This is an L sugar. And so that's where the little D and L come from in terms of the name. The D or L does not tell you about all the other stereocenters. All the rest of the stereocenters, all of these guys, their orientation must be memorized. So if I'm dealing with glucose, then I just need to remember what the orientation of those different hydroxyl groups are in terms of glucose. And the last one is told to me by the D or the L, which is a little bit confusing to most people. But that's how they did it. That's how they went through and did the Fisher projections. So Fisher projections, I really don't use Fisher projections very often. Fisher projections are used mainly when we get into carbohydrates. We can use them for things other than carbohydrates. It can be convenient sometimes. So for instance, if I happen to have a molecule that has a few stereocenters in it, and I have, let's say, two bromines, and I want to draw this as a Fisher projection, then I can do that by taking and putting in the aldehyde and drawing the lines across. And I would need to sort out what side the bromines are going to be on. And I would do it exactly the same way as I did last time. I would stand this thing up and I would look at it from this angle. I would make sure that this was pointed towards me. And when I do that, that pointed towards me is going to put that bromine on the right. I would need to rotate this around so that it's pointed towards me. That's going to put the bromine forward. That's also going to be on the right. And so this molecule would be this guy as a Fisher projection. So it can be represented that way, but for most of the things that we do, it's not really all that convenient because most of the time we're looking at doing chemical reactions and trying to see this as a chemical reaction or doing a chemical reaction on this thing is not easy. What it is easy for is Fisher projections make it easy in order to draw enantiomers and diastereomers, or to be able to tell the difference between enantiomers and diastereomers. So Fisher projections, not good for reactions, but good for enantiomers and diastereomer relationships. In other words, what I can do is with a Fisher projection, I can take and draw a Fisher projection, and I can very quickly draw that molecule as an enantiomer. Because I can very simply draw the mirror image. Or I can check it, and I can check it up against another molecule, and I can say, what is the relationship between these two molecules? And and in drawing these two, what we can see is that this stereocenter here is the same, but the stereocenter that is here, this guy, is different. And because only one has been flipped, then these guys are diastereomers. In the molecule that I did here, I could view it this way, that both centers have been flipped. And because all of the stereocenters have been flipped, that one's clearly enantiomers. And so it makes it really easy to be able to discern the difference between enantiomers and diastereomers by looking at Fisher projections. But other than that, it's really not helpful in terms of chemical reactions, which is where we're going later. So until we get to carbohydrates and dealing with carbohydrates, we kind of put Fisher projections on hold for the most part. But it's good to deal with them just so that you've seen them so that when we do get to carbohydrates, you've at least seen them before and have a foundation to work with. So the last part in this chapter is dealing with resolution. So in dealing with resolution, resolution is a process by which we separate enantiomers. In resolution, enantiomers have the same boiling points. So they have same boiling points, melting points, polarity. They have the same density. They have the same every physical property. Except the rotational plane polarized light. And what that means is that it is very difficult to separate them. You need to come up with some very special tricks to be able to separate them. The first time this was done, actually, was done with tartaric acid, sodium tartrate. And it was done by Pasteur. And what Pasteur had recognized was that he was getting different crystals that were crystallizing in a dish that he had sodium tartrate in. And the first time that this was done, was Louis Pasteur. Make sure I do his name right, E-U-R. And what Pasteur was doing was just crystallizing racemic tartrate salts. So racemic meaning 50-50. And what he observed was that the salts crystallized in two different patterns. And he started using a magnifying glass and tweezers, and he picked out the different patterns in crystal patterns. And he put them into different dishes and then redissolved it and basically resolved the crystals by their crystal structure. So tartrate, if we look at tartrate, we can look at it easily as its Fischer projection. So this would be the carboxylic acid. And then it has two hydroxyl groups and then another carboxylic acid or carboxylate group. So there's the sodium salt there and the sodium salt there. That's one isomer, and the other isomer, it's an enantiomer, so we have to flip each of the stereocenters. There's there's free rotation about the carboxylate, and so the carboxylate doesn't need to be rotated in order to draw it as the enantiomer. So these are the enantiomers. And one of these forms more like needles, and the other one platelets, as I seem to recall. And their crystal structures were different. And what Pasteur did is just separated them. So that worked, but it doesn't work for everything because not everything has different crystal structures. And we can't just sit there and crystallize them and pick them out with the tweezers every time we want to do a resolution. So because all of the physical properties are the same, the melting point, the boiling point, the polarity, the density, all the ways that we would normally separate something out by chromatography or by distillation or any of those other things that we might try or seek to use to resolve enantiomers does not work. So we need to come up with some other trick. So the trick that we use is called a chiral resolving agent. So in a chiral resolving agent, what we do is we use let me explain. Let's say that we have racemic amphetamine that we want to resolve. Amphetamine is a molecule that has a stereogenic center in it. So the stereogenic center is here. We'll draw it as the methyl group. This is an H2 group. And we've got an aromatic ring there. This is plus minus, meaning that it's a 50-50 mix. And what we want to do is we want to resolve it. So we have in here the R minus amphetamine. The R minus has the methyl group down. And we have the S plus. And that's going to have the methyl group forward. And what we want to do is we want to separate these two out. So the way that we do that is we react them together with another molecule. We choose a molecule that has properties that will react with these. And because each one of these positions here, the NH2, these guys are basic functional groups. One of the things that we can do is we can react this with an acid. So we choose a readily available, pure, enantiomerically pure acid. What we choose is tartaric acid, something that is readily available from commercial winemaking, that when you make wine, one of the byproducts of the fermentation that happens is the production of tartaric acid. And because it's produced by a living organism, it's produced as a single enantiomer. So this is 2R3R plus tartaric acid. Each one of the hydroxyl groups in the center here are forward. So this is 2R, comma 3R. And it rotates light in the positive direction, clockwise direction, tartaric acid. This is a single enantiomer, enantiomerically pure. And when I react these two together, this one has acidic functional groups. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make salts. We're going to protonate the amine, deprotonate the tartaric acid, and we're going to make salts. So the salts that we make when we combine these two together is we get the NH3 now with a positive charge. So this is the amphetamine cation. This is the R minus amphetamine. And the counter ion to this is the tartaric acid. But now that tartaric acid is in an anion form. And this is the 2R3R plus tartaric acid. And we'll call it the tartrate. On the other side, we get the enantiomer of the amphetamine. This one also now as a salt. This is the forward. This is the S and the plus. And this is the amphetamine. And this is combined with the same tartrate. Not the enantiomer of the tartrate, the same tartrate. I know it's a lot of drawing, but there's no other way to do it. Now this makes two different salts, and what I'm going to say is that these salts are combined together. They're cation and anion. So let me take and render these salts just by looking at it this way. This is the R from the amphetamine combined with 2R, 3R. This is the S from the amphetamine combined with 2R, 3R from the tartrate. Look at this here. I'll do all the R's in red. And I'll do the S in blue. What is the relationship of these two salts? How would I describe these two salts in a relationship wise? So these are salts that are produced. These salts, if it were R, 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 and S, 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 they would be enantiomeric salts. But because it's a salt that is R, 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 S, R, R, these salts are now diastereomers. They're diastereomeric salts. Diastereomers have different physical properties. They are no longer enantiomers. We have broken the enantiomers and we have turned them into diastereomers. When you turn something into a diastereomer, now they have different physical properties. Diastereomers have all different physical properties. They have different boiling points, melting points, solubility. And that actually turns out to be the key thing. They have different dipole moments. They have different everything, all the different physical properties. They're all different. But the solubility here is the key thing. Because these have different solubilities, when these are in solution, as the solution becomes concentrated, one of them is more soluble than the other. And one of them will precipitate out of solution ahead of the other one. And so we use solubility to selectively precipitate the less soluble. So we use solubility to precipitate the less soluble diastereomeric pair. And I'm wishing that I knew exactly which one was less soluble. I don't have it. But one of these becomes less soluble. And then what we do is, let's just say that one of these is less soluble. Let's call this one over here on the right. We'll say this one is less soluble. This guy over here on the left is more soluble. And so what happens is this one precipitates out. As it precipitates out, what we do is we filter it, we capture it, and then we do what's called freebase it. We react it with sodium hydroxide, and we free the base, we deprotonate it, and then we isolate the amphetamine pure. And so the process is to take that salt we precipitate it, we filter, we free base. In freebasing, what that means is that we react with sodium hydroxide. And what that does is that takes that salt do it this way, that was NH3 with a positive charge on it. This was the forward one. Go back and make sure I've got the right one. It is. So we take that guy and we react it with sodium hydroxide. The base pulls the proton, taking the proton away from that ammonium ion and turns it into the neutral compound. And then we can evaporate the solvent. And we get this material pure. We have separated it. And we can separate out the other isomer because it is in solution pure too. So we could take that one and we could freebase it directly. and we come up with, which one was this? This was the S amphetamine. And this is now 100% enantiomeric excess. It is a single isomer. And we could say that this has now been resolved. So that's what a resolution is. A resolution is using some other chiral molecule to create diastereomers to give them different physical properties such that they can be resolved. And whatever molecule I use that is a chiral molecule that is a single isomer, the reaction has to be reversible. And so we typically choose acid-base reactions to do these chiral resolutions with, provided that the molecules that we're trying to resolve have an acid or basic functional group on it. That's the main key to doing that. If the molecules don't have a chiral acid or base functional group on them, we can still do resolutions, but we need to resort to other types of resolutions. So a third type that we can do, third type of resolution, is chiral chromatography. I'll introduce that later on when we get into looking at chromatography, but essentially what we do is we use a chiral molecule as a substrate that we pass the mixture over or through. And because it interacts differently with the different isomers, it creates diastereomeric combinations that slows one of the enantiomers down as opposed to the other and allows us to resolve them. It's a very expensive way to go about and to try to separate things, but can be very successful. So that's the big thing on how we separate them. So the last thing that I've got 5 minutes left here. I want to go through a little bit of notation. We've used a number of different notations for distinguishing enantiomers. These notations are plus and minus. We have a lowercase d italicized and a lowercase L italicized. We have a capital R and a capital S, and we have an uppercase but small d and an uppercase but small L. So these are small caps. So plus and minus, these are the sign of rotation of light. That sign of rotation of light is the rotation, the optical rotation that we observe for chiral molecules. This is a physical property. Of the molecule. Then we have that lowercase d and lowercase l. Lowercase d equals dextrorotatory. That equals plus. And the lowercase l, levorotatory. And that equals minus. So D and L are also physical properties and are the rotation of plane polarized light. They're just a different way of designating plus and designating minus. Then we have R and S. And R and S are configurations that are based on the Kahn-Engel-Prelog rules. They are not physical properties. They are a man-made system and a way of designating forwards or backwards based on using the Kahn-Engel-Prelog rules. So these are configurations of a stereo center. I should say a single stereo center. Based on Kahn-Engel-Prelog rules. And here, when we put them in the right orientation, 1, 2, and 3, and I'm looking at these groups as they are based on the Kahn-Engel-Prelog rules, if I'm going around this way, and this is counterclockwise, this is an S orientation. And then if I'm going around and it's 1, 2, and 3, and this is in a clockwise orientation, this is an R orientation. So these are just designations in terms of the Kahn-Engel-Prelog rules. D and L then, what do D and L stand for? D and L are based on the Fisher projections. So these are not about specific stereo centers, but specifically for the Fisher projection. So these are small caps and designate the highest priority group on the last chiral center in a Fisher projection. So those are all of the sort of notations that we've used. And I guess I could add in there really quick, chiral, achiral, meso. We can throw in a few other things just to summarize. Maybe I'll finish those out real quick. So chiral. Chiral is a molecule that rotates plane polarized light. Due to having stereogenic centers. Achiral means that a molecule does not rotate, plays polarized light. That could be for two reasons. It could be either no stereogenic centers, or could be meso, meaning that it has stereogenic centers, but that there's a plane of symmetry in the molecule such that it doesn't rotate plane polarized light. Which means that we should define meso. Meso means that the molecule has plane of symmetry. and does not rotate plane polarized light. If the last few things is racemic, this is a 50-50 mix of enantiomers, can be represented as plus minus, different ways to represent it. We could say enantiomerically pure. This is something that is a single isomer. This is something that is 100% EE. Non-racemic. Equals something that has not 50-50. Has greater than 0% EE. And I think that's all of them, just listing them all out in terms of all the different terms that we've used. So I think that finishes up all of the stereochemistry section. We've gone through and we've looked at all the different aspects now. And the main focus in the stereochemistry section is being able to figure out whether something is R or S, being able to write out and look at the relationship between two things, whether they are enantiomers or whether they're diastereomers. Those are the key things. Looking at calculating enantiomeric excess, calculating the sign of rotation, all of those things are sort of secondary. They're important, but they're not as important. Mainly what we do is we go forward from here, understanding that molecules have stereocenters and that those stereogenic centers are going to be important when we look at chemical reactions that involve those stereogenic centers and what happens to them and whether or not their stereochemistry is retained or whether or not their stereochemistry is inverted. And so it's important to the topic as we move forward and start looking at chemical reactions. All right. So when we get done here, when we come back on Thursday, we'll look at chapter 6, we'll look at energy. And then after chapter 6, we start getting into chemical reactions into chapter 7. So chapter 6, I'm not going to do everything that's in the book in chapter 6. I'm going to select out a few topics that I think are really critically important, and we'll focus on those. And so we'll sort of truncate chapter 6 so that we can speed it up and get into chapter 7 and start looking at chemical reactions at that point. All right, that's the game plan. I'm going to cut it there, stop the share, and I'm going to see you guys tomorrow for lab, and then I'll see you back again on Thursday. All right. All right, let's call it.
Thanks, Jason.